The Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers. Investment advisors, switch to Interactive Brokers for lowest cost global trading and turnkey custody solutions. No ticket charges, no custody fees, no minimums, and no conflicts of interest at ibkr.com/RIA.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets do a double take as rates spike on inflation fears. The Momo stocks are taking a beating, and the meme stocks are taking off, then fizzling. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Leeb, author of China's Rise and the New Age of Gold. All this and much more on episode number 703 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's the end of February. We're moving into the depths of winter. I hope your pipes are working. You have electric. You're staying warm. And that you are not in the path of any of these crazy winter storms that have been plaguing much of the U.S. Welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz. And for those of you who are just joining in, I founded Horowitz & Company many years ago. I won't tell you how long, but let's just say it was, 30 years ago. We do investment advisory. That's what we do. We're an investment management firm. Basically, what we do is help people like you every day with their investments and their financial plans. And I tell you that because I want to make sure you understand this is not an exercise in just theory. What we talk about each and every week are things that are really important for you to understand about what it is that is going on in the markets, in the environment, with the economy, in the world, that really has important implications for your money. So these are the topics we talk about. You, of course, can write me at any time. Ask me what you have a question about. Tell me what's on your mind over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you go there, top right, there's a little button, and basically it says Ask Andrew. Makes it very easy. Just go there and pipe in your question. We'll either answer it directly or I'll put on the show, because sometimes the questions that you ask are really pertinent for others to understand and to hear. Now, a quick note, I want to mention what's happening next week, because we are starting to enter into that time that we all hate. Yeah. Tax time. Well, there's a few things that are going on that I think I need some clarification on, and I know you probably do as well. We have our guest, Dan Pilla, coming on talking taxes, because I want to understand about some of the areas that I think are really going to be a problem for many people who received unemployment compensation, possibly other benefits in 2020. So make sure to listen, because we're going to flush out that discussion to understand better about what to do, to make sure there's no traps lying on the other side. So when the April turns around and comes and you see that tax return, you're not like, uh-oh, I didn't know I was going to owe money on that. So we're going to get to all of that next week. Last week was great. I know we had some audio problems on the first day that it was uploaded, but the file is good now. Unbelievable discussion, I thought, with Carson Block from Money Waters. And if you want to understand more about what's happening in China and the opportunity for short positioning in the markets, I know we all kind of hate short sellers right now. They're the downfall of all markets. It should only go up all the time. And we talk about where there is actually some benefits to all of us from the short sellers. So listen into that. Now, let's talk about where we are now. Clearly, it was a quote-unquote an interesting week. In fact, I would go so far as saying it was a bloodbath for a lot of names. And last week, if you've been following me on Twitter, which is my name, Andrew Horowitz, I speculated that when there was going to be a reversal of the money flows into the popular ARK investment ETFs, that we could see a serious market event unfold. Because the names that have been the winners that have run up so dramatically, you know the names, I mean, whether it is inside the 3D printing space or biotechs or maybe the electric vehicles, if those started to get unwound and there was going to be a sell of ARK and all the money that they would possibly need to start selling to make the redemptions, well, that's kind of what happened. Now, I don't necessarily blame it on ARK investors or ARK themselves with other factors that paved the way for some of this. And I think my timing on the discussion was a little bit fortuitous. It was just, you know, I was thinking about it. I mentioned it. But I think it's something that we need to really be wary of, the crowded trade. Because right now, everybody seems to be on one side. And I want you to envision something and think about what happens here. Think about a small boat, maybe bigger than a rowboat, but smaller than a party boat, if you will. And all of a sudden, people start to walk to one side. Let's say it's the port side or the left side. And more people start coming that way. And the boat starts to tip ever so slightly. So what happens? Quickly, everybody's like, oh my God, the boat's moving over there. We need to get all of us at the same time get to the other side, which is the starboard side or the right-hand side of the boat. And then what happens? Well, in our first example, people were kind of moseying along and going slowly but surely and moving to the left side of the boat until they realized, you know what, maybe it's kind of getting a little tippy. In the second part of this discussion, we said, well, everybody ran to the other side of the boat. And you know what? That boat tips over. It flips. This is something that also happens when there's a chase for profits. There will be some time until that boat can get righted again. And during that time, though, where we are right now with that boat flipping over a little bit, there's a lot of people in the water panicking. And that's kind of what we saw last week. And that panic brought on more panic and concern, people selling. And if you didn't notice, maybe you saw the end of day returns on markets. And you said, well, not a big deal on that one day. It only finished down or up a little bit. But on Tuesday, for example, and on Thursday and Wednesday, and then on Friday again, there was crazy moves of individual names. In particular, earlier in the week, we saw a 400 or 500 point move on the NASDAQ only to turn around as word was getting out, yes, that ARK Investments, Cathie Wood, was buying more Tesla, moved her position up from 8.5% in the ARKK fund, that ETF, that's the symbol, to 10%. So kind of not only bringing it back to position, but adding more to it. And that took Tesla from down, I think it was down like 11% or something crazy, basically up for the day. And this is what's going on right now. These massive moves are really something we need to take notice of. Now, why did this happen? Well, part of it could be blamed on the idea of something I have been talking about and we talked about here many times is the idea that, hey, we have inflation. And I've said this 1,000 times. You know what? Even though the Fed says we don't have inflation, but yet everything is costing more, and we see the commodity prices like lumber and copper and fuel and foodstuffs all going up, well, that's starting to impact bond yields. And when we saw a skew event last week where all of a sudden, the 10-year Treasury, as an example, busted above 1.5% and then flew. Just for a moment, markets panicked. Came back down towards the end of the week a bit, so that was better. but we're still resting very close, dangerously close to a number that a lot of people are pegging as, hey, you know what? We need to pay attention to the 1.5% 10-year level, not to mention all the other levels. Now, while that may be very good for some parts of the market, it's not going to be good for credit. It's probably not going to be good for the Momo and the growth and the highly speculative names. It's not going to be good for margin expansion and PE multiple expansion because it's just not. Now, even though we've talked about how the narrative has gone from, well, low rates are very supportive and pretty good for the fact that we can have very, very high levels of overall multiples because, you know what, when we do this calculation, it works. And I've talked about this a lot. Then it changed to, hey, you know what, good news. We see inflation and we see bond yields coming up. That's supportive of higher multiples as well because, well, the economy is doing better. That will trickle down to stocks. You can't have it both ways. And that's what I've been talking about. The people on the talking heads on TV just, you know, they have one direction they talk about and build their story around it all the time. Where we are now is in an inflection point. I don't think the Fed is going to quote unquote allow for yields to continue to move higher as they have. But right now there's a question about whether or not they actually are losing control. And the question also is, do I think this is over? Do I think that we are at the end of this volatility right now? Not yet. The VIX is elevated at about 27. It's down from a peak of about 30 or so this week. And while there was pain on a lot of the days throughout this week, buyers quickly stepped in and grabbed up shares. We saw that over and over. And usually until there is an all-out panic and people are just throwing in the towel, it's usually not quite over. Now, again, we're living in a different kind of environment. I'll give you that. We're living in a circumstance where there is enormous liquidity. Over the weekend, the House paved the way to passing the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill. So there's a lot more money that's going to flow in once that passes. And no, they didn't get the $15 per hour of minimum wage on a federally mandated basis. But okay, still a lot of money inside of this stimulus program. And looking at February at the close of the month, I mean, markets ended up. Markets ended higher. The big winners were small caps, value. The laggards were tech and growth. And as interest rates moved higher throughout the month, you know, banks and industrials moved up really nicely. And that's what we would expect. That's kind of at least things are working correctly. But when we have a situation where we've had a massive run-up on a speculative run-up for a lot of the different names out there, just some of the air is coming out of it right now. Do I think there's going to be a crash? I don't know. I don't know what's a crash anymore. You know, we've lived through March 2020 and came out the other side, well, for a lot of stocks, better for it. Companies have gotten lean and mean. And with the continuation of low rates, generally speaking, by the Fed, even if rates tick up a little bit, even if there's inflation, and with the bond buying program and stimulus, and maybe even another stimulus program in the works moving forward, you have to think about that. There's still a pretty good backdrop longer term for equity. So maybe it's creating a good buying opportunity in terms of the timing of this right now. In other words, maybe there's, if you have powder dry, which we do on all of our portfolios, maybe there's an opportunity to pick up some things right now or soon at good pricing. I don't know necessarily you have to rush into it, even though the markets constantly are turning and moving back up on really no data. But one of the things that's interesting is that some of the things that you would expect to benefit, like metals, precious metals, didn't have such a great month. And that's something I want to discuss with our guest because he really has a great deal of knowledge in the area of, well, we'll call it commodities. And those are the things that inflation should be helping. But again, something's a little bit off here. But before we do that, I want to share this with you because so many people something's a hidden, right? Once you hear about it, you're like, oh, now that makes sense. Some things are hard to find. You have to kind of dig through. And there's a program that's available through Interactive Brokers that will help you earn extra income on your portfolio. And if you're like anybody else, aren't you looking for ways to earn extra income? Well, Interactive Brokers has this thing called a stock yield enhancement program. And what that does is it lets you earn extra income on fully paid shares of stock inside of your brokerage account. So basically, how it works is this, that your shares are lent out to traders who pay an interest rate to borrow them, and you receive 50% of the income that's earned. It's that simple. You can open an Interactive Brokers account today and start earning extra income and learn more about this at ibkr.com/SYEP. I want you to go there and check it out because if it's something that you haven't really thought about and you have positions in your portfolio that maybe have been there for a long period of time and you're thinking about keeping them for a longer period of time, even into the future, why not make some extra money from it? Check out ibkr.com/SYEP. Now let's get back to this discussion about metals and let's bring on our guest. And our guest today is Stephen Leeb. He's the author of China's Rise and the New Age of Gold, How Investors Can Profit from a Changing World, and editor of the award-winning publication, The Complete Investor. Now, Steve's been around for a while. I've actually followed some of his work over the years, and he's been in the business probably as long as I have. He's also a University of Pennsylvania Wharton School of Business graduate and holds a PhD in psychology and Masters of Mathematics in the university and an epic chess player. Steve, how are you?
Okay, you misstated my chess skills. I enjoy playing, but I'm fine, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Which he's humble too, obviously. But nonetheless, we talked a little bit about some of this before. Hey, listen, so I want to talk about a lot of the things that are going on around the world. You know, obviously you've had your sights set on and doing a lot of research on the area of currencies and commodities and gold in China. And I really want to focus in today on the whole idea of gold because, you know, we've seen that it appears that there is a debasement of the currencies, not only here in the United States, but around the world. We see that there's the rise of the cryptocurrency alternative assets that's happening. We see the potential for inflation. So I want to start with that first. Inflation. Is gold still a good inflation hedge here in 2021?
Yes, it is, Andrew. And I think going forward, it will become an ever better inflation hedge. Gold's had a little bit of a rough time beginning of 2021. And, you know, it could actually have a rough time for this entire year. But what you're seeing in 2021, I think the biggest takeaway right now is the behavior of commodity prices. I mean, as I look right now at my screen, I see copper at 391. This is close to a decade high. And the same is true for raw commodities in general. The only commodity that's lagging has been oil. And that's been an outlier for a while because of fracking. But even oil has managed, you know, if you look at averages over 5 weeks, oil is actually up about 100% from its low. So yep. Even that's participating, and we really have seen nothing yet. And one reason for liking gold, for, you know, really expecting big things from gold this time, is that short of a multitude of economic or technological massive breakthroughs, I cannot connect the dots that will allow the commodities that we have available to us today really build out a new energy system and really allow the developing world to continue to develop. And it's really like this force of development, this force of new energies, this is running head on into limitations in terms of commodities. And you're really seeing a taste of it much sooner than I thought with this incredible move that, well, I can't say incredible, but it's one of the most dynamic, strongest moves we've had in commodities. The only two that rival it would be 2000, the beginning of this century, and in the 1970s. You haven't seen anything like that.
So when you talk about commodities, though, that's the great pool of commodities, right? And we've seen, of course, lumber prices going crazy and skyrocketing. We've seen things like copper and, of course, all the other industrial metals, platinum doing some crazy things, gold, silver picking up a little bit. But is a lot of that tied to necessarily a natural process of development, or is this forced hand of China doing what they can to build and pretty much just corner the market on a lot of this stuff for their potential development, or and the incredible amount of stimulus that's being put into the system? I mean, we see the home numbers in the United States. I mean, historic high pricing of houses once again. I mean, where are the limitations?
I in terms of commodities, I don't think that, I mean, the limitations are access to commodities themselves and the fact that most commodities are related to one another. And, you know, the common denominator there is energy, is oil. And other energies too. And the limitations that we have in terms of those other energies, and, you know, because of you're going to, you know, basically run short. And also, as you mentioned, China is at the center of this. They have come a long way in a very short period of time. And they have basically coalesced much of the world's emerging economies around them. And there's still, when you look at the emerging economies and the developing economies, you want us to talk about inequalities in America and in some of the other Western economies. The inequalities between countries is still enormous. Mm-hmm. It's still, in terms of a GDP per capita, it's still about 9 to 1. Which means that the typical person in 85% of the world, that's what the developing world represents, 85% of the population of this world has a per capita GDP 1/9 of what the developed world has, and much less than that with the US. So that is coming on. The developing world started coming on, and now it's coming on much, much stronger. I mean, one data point I guess I should mention is that when you look at the first generation of this century, starting in 2000 and ending, let's say, in 2019, the best performing asset, and I'm not talking by a small margin, your best performing asset class was gold by far. Gold climbed 400%, fivefold, during that generation. The S&P dividends reinvested climbed about 200% or threefold. But gold wasn't alone. Gold was the strongest performer, but gold was not alone. Other commodities that outperformed the S&P 500 were silver, iron ore, and copper. And what you're going to see in the next 20 years, I mean, I think the writing is on the wall. If you look at the International Energy Agency, you'll see their estimates for spending on commodities, they say energy, but you can't separate energy from other commodities, is much greater than it was in the first, in the last generation. And I just don't see how you connect the dots. I honestly don't.
So let's bring this together, though. So the subtext of this discussion right now, first, is that the continuation of an economic boom, a renaissance, development of the undeveloped is going to continue. Did I grab that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. That's right on.
So that's the subtext, number one. Number two, the fuel for that, or the required input for that to continue, is going to be a build out of infrastructure. It's going to be a continuation of an expansion in manufacturing. And all those things lead to the requirement to utilize more commodities. That's the second point, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So I'm following along. So good. All right. Let's see if I go off the rails here at all. Where in this, while I understand things like iron ore and I understand the energy, whether it's natural gas or it's possibly oil, crude oil, or some other kind of distillate, where does gold fit into this? Because it's not necessarily thought of as an industrial metal.
That's exactly its advantage. It is not an industrial metal. And that's exactly why I believe you are going to need gold. Because if you have a shortage of commodities, and I'm talking, you know, copper and electrification. I mean, it's not just energy. It's not oil and gas are not going to be the leaders in terms of growing. It's going to have to come from other places like nuclear, certainly our great desire, our great hope, or oil, I mean, oil, solar, wind, renewables. And to get enough of those renewable energies to make any difference whatsoever is going to take massive amounts of commodities. For example, in electric vehicles, the amount of copper needed is enormous, much, much greater than what you need in internal combustion engine vehicles. And I think that's one reason you're seeing, you know, this explosive move right now in copper. And when you have an explosive move in a critical commodity, it tends to drag other commodities up with it because, you know, it makes other commodities that use copper to be mined, they start going up in price, et cetera. And where gold comes in, I know that's
now that's what
question.
I'm asking because I'm still not seeing it. I'm not getting the relationship here.
Okay. All commodities are going up. There's a shortage. There has to be a way of allocating those commodities efficiently. And that to me, and again, this is everything I've been saying right now is not speculative. This part of it is a bit speculative. But my sense of gold is that it's the one commodity that can serve the purpose if it backs up, let's say, a basket of currencies, which is what I expect, a digital basket of currencies, which is what I wrote about in the recent book. And that will be able to back up a collection of currencies and, in a way, allocate reserve currencies. Because if you allow the dollar to maintain its, you know, role as the world's only reserve currency, you're going to run into trouble. And because the dollar will be able to just print, will be able to print as many dollars as we want to try and secure our supply of commodities. We've already spent, just in terms of fracking, probably $1 trillion in lost money. Fracking has been a negative. I mean, it hasn't earned any money. I mean, cash flows. If you count opportunity costs, what else you could have spent that money on, namely solar, wind, etc., rather than in terms of, you know, fracking's very, very expensive because it uses other commodities, etc. We've lost about $1 trillion, but we can do that. We can afford to do whatever we want because we're the reserve currency. And I don't think that the world can really stand together if that sort of currency, or if we have a reserve currency that is, you know, a sovereign currency, a fiat currency, et cetera. I'm not a gold bug. I mean, basically what I see is that the only way this planet, I don't mean to sound utterly dramatic about this, but the only way in the face of these kinds of commodity shortages that the planet can stay together is that if we work together. And as a planet, I mean, we all have horrible flaws, every country. I mean, China maybe especially, but we, you know, can name our flaws too. We have to come together, Andrew.
Yeah.
And gold, what you said about gold is exactly why it is the commodity that can back up everything, because it's the one commodity that, by virtue of its industrial uses, is not going to ever run short. Every ounce of gold that we've mined, according to the lot of people. That might be an exaggeration, but almost all the gold that we've ever mined still exists. It's very difficult to destroy. Gold is probably the only commodity that is valued, not for its industrial uses. It's valued because, well, you could
argue. Scarcity. It's supply-demand, right?
Well, yes, but what causes the demand? The demand is not caused because it's needed for industrial uses. That's the point. The demand is caused, I think, because it's, you know, it's considered a beautiful metal. And there's a lot of very, very special chemical traits that make gold intrinsically beautiful. Now, you can be somebody that believes in, you know, what Plato said, that there are these things, there are these shapes and forms that are naturally beautiful, or you could just believe it goes back 5,000 years, you can't destroy it. People treasure gold for itself, not because it can do something for them. Silver has also been a monetary metal, and it's also beautiful, but not as beautiful as gold. And silver does have massive industrial demand. It's the most conductive metal in terms of both heat and electricity that you can find. You can't duplicate it. And it's desperately needed. And I see shortages in silver, shortages in copper, and what you're seeing in food prices. But you're really seeing all these commodities. I mean, the agriculture, the above ground commodities, the below ground commodities like copper, and whether they're ferrous or non-ferrous, iron ore, zinc, copper, et cetera, they're all going up at the same time. And, you know, this is really signs that, you know, you're going to run into some sort of trouble. I mean, people have to eat. People have to, they're going to need copper.
Well, by the way, let me interrupt you for a second. You know, one of the things I've always had a problem with is the idea of having a futures market surrounding my food. In other words, the idea that speculators can invest money in a critical item that I need for survival. Like, do I need oil for survival? Not really, right? Do I need silver for survival? No, I don't need silver for survival. I do need wheat, potentially. I do need cattle. I do need pork, you know, depending on what I'm eating, okay? I'm surprised there's no futures market on fish. Or squid. Squid futures.
We could probably find one somewhere.
Yeah, I want squid futures is what I want, okay?
Yes.
But the thing is that the availability of speculators, I'm not talking about hedgers. That's a kind of a different discussion, right?
Totally. That's what futures were created for.
Right.
Yes.
They were, and they were bastardized like everything else for the financial benefit of it. But the ability for future traders to actually set prices potentially on wheat, corn, soybeans. I've always had a problem with that. Do you?
Yes. Oh, okay. I have a problem with it now with their setting prices on copper and everything else. And I think that one of the things that you're going to see and probably will, you know, ring a bell is that the margins that the bankers are going to have to hold on future settlement is going to go up dramatically. Supposedly, I think around June 1st, the Bank of International Settlements is going to try and weave in much, much higher margins so that the speculators and the speculation that goes on in futures trading is may be sharply limited. Now, it's going to take a little while for that to hit, but I think the BIS, Bank of International Settlements, I think certainly China. And, you know, I don't know where the U.S.'s position is on this, but I think a lot of people see that this is wrong. And it's especially wrong, you're totally right, when it comes to food. And you need some other mechanism for controlling these prices and for allocating these commodities in a fair and good way. You know, companies or countries that are good at developing let's say wheat and corn, they should have more money to do this, et cetera. I mean, this is going to be, in my opinion, Andrew, this is going to be one of probably the largest challenge to our civilization that humankind has ever experienced. I don't mean to sound overly dramatic.
It's a little dramatic, but I agree. I mean, we have a limited supply. I mean, there is only one planet Earth. Maybe that's why Elon Musk is thinking about colonizing Mars to do some kind of digging for I don't know what. But so let me just let me rewind this a second here, because one of the things you keep on talking about is working together. Number one, you talk about the potential for development and expansion of many of the emerging economies around the world.
Going to happen, yes.
And you talk about the gold. Now, I think you were hinting, I heard it in there, about going back to a gold standard of something, somehow. Is that something you are either
very
advocating
much
or thinking
that's... Not the gold bugs type of gold standard. Basically what I see, and this is speculative, I mean, it could work out some other way, but gold's going to be involved in that, in it, and it's going to depend on the kind of cooperation we can develop with the developing world. I mean, 15% of us are in the developed world, and we live, well, people would argue, a pretty good life in terms of material things, and 85% of the world is not. So it could just apply, you know, to certain countries, which would be a great shame. But what I see is China right now is initiating what they are saying is a digital yuan, and they will be showing it off in Hong Kong.
Yeah, they're giving out free. It's like store credit cards or it's like gift cards of this quote unquote digital yuan. I don't know what the difference is between that and just sending out a MasterCard with the pre-fill of $20 on it.
Well, I think the difference is that it's much easier to control the supply, for one thing. And it's also going to be, in my opinion, a prelude to a digital basket of currencies. I mean, this was what, you know, when you go back to Bretton Woods, initially SDRs were created with this in mind, not so that we would not have a single country with a, you know, as a reserve currency. And when 2007 and 2008 and 2009 came along, the chairman of the PBOC, Joe, I think you pronounced his name, is a brilliant guy. And he wrote a little white paper where he did everything but mention gold as something that would back up a collection of currencies like the SDR as a suitable reserve currency. And if you look at, you know, some Chinese writing, actually in Chinese, I don't think any of this stuff has ever been published in English, you will see that they're saying exactly this. And they're saying that, you know, and this is really important to realize about China, they don't want to be the reserve currency. This is not a battle between the yuan and the dollar. By no means. It's a battle between a basket of currencies and the dollar.
I think it's actually a dollar. It's not a defined a battle on the other side. It's a battle to get the U.S. as the reserve currency, or the world off of the U.S. as a reserve currency. That's the battle.
Right, but not to exclude the U.S.
Right, correct.
As a role
correct.
In the reserve currency.
Yeah, but I don't think. Listen, I've kind of thought through this and all that. I just, with who we are and what we are, and now we have all this negativity about China, and the thought that we're so far above everybody else, and the thought of us breaking from being the sole and exclusive reserve currency of the world seems pretty far fetched for me.
It's going to be tough. And that's why I said that it might just be the developing world that comes together. I mean, you know, what we've done, we really don't lead in very much at this point. You cannot find any significant supply chain that we have in this country. I mean, one thing that really shocked me more than anything recently is that we don't even have the ability to make pure silicon in this country, the kind that you need to make integrated circuits, the kind that you need for, everything that we do. We're dependent. It's not just rare earths, which people have read a lot about, and I won't go into that. But I mean, it's obviously we don't have any of those either. And, you know, without rare earths, the only thing I'll cite is that our military becomes circa 1979. That's, if we don't have access to rare earths, we cannot run a modern military. And China has these supply chains. I mean, you can't name a critical supply chain, whether it be in technology. Well, technology now, you know, there's been all these sanctions, again, because we have the reserve currency, and that's our lasting, that's our only real claim to hegemony in, of any sort, is the reserve currency. It's not technology. I mean, it's not education. It's not healthcare. It really is, you know, our reserve currency. And let me just make this one quick point. I know I'm going on, but you mentioned the financial institutions and Elon Musk. That's one of the major problems in this country today. Is I mentioned earlier, gold has been the best performing asset this century. And all you've been, meaning all you had to do at the beginning of the century is buy a bunch of gold, bury it in your backyard, and you know, you would have outperformed almost everybody else. Mm-hmm. But you don't hear that from the financial industry. But you do hear a lot of talk about Bitcoin.
Right.
And Elon Musk the other day, and this shocked me, to be very honest, bought a bunch of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin is one of the most energy intensive assets that we know.
That is very much under discussed. It takes to mind what we do in a year. It's like the full energy of like Sweden.
It's getting more. At 50,000, it's the amount of energy that I think every Tesla sold in 2019 or 2020 will consume in terms of solar power. That's how much Bitcoin at 50,000. Now, you've heard targets of 500,000. Well, that would account for all the solar energy
that we're producing on this planet. The problem is you don't see the tailpipe. That's what the thing is, right? You know, the fact is, we talked about this on a show recently, electricity. You know, everybody thinks that, oh, I'm going to get electric to charge my car. So I'm just going to plug it in that cool little plug down there and I'll turn the lamp on. Energy, one of the biggest methods of creation of energy is, well, we have nuclear power, some solar, but it's coal. It's coal.
Yes. And it's dirty. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And you're going to have to, you know, develop technologies for, you know, the gasification of coal and doing it in a fairly clean way. I mean, companies like Air Products and Chemical, you know, they're very much involved in that and others too. I'm not recommending a particular stock. I'm just saying that this is a technology that, you know, is going to have to be developed. I mean, you're not going to do everything with solar and with wind, but it could help and it could help a lot. But this is where silver comes in, Andrew. I mean, you cannot make a solar panel today without using silver. Now, we've thrifted a lot of silver. I mean, in other words, we use much less silver now in making solar than we did, let's say, 10 years ago, but you reach a limit. And we're at that limit, very, very close to it. So if you're going to build out solar and multiply it by 10 or 20 fold, and it still won't make that much of a difference, you're going to need massive amounts of silver. I mean, actually, for the first part of this bull market in these metals, you will probably see silver outperforming gold, even though at the end of the day, you know, my ultimate scenario, and again, very speculative, is that you have a basket of, and this is sort of utopian almost, but you have a basket of currencies of which the dollar's a member, the yuan's a member, the pound, all the, you know, the usual suspects, major countries. And you have gold backing it up. And just like our Federal Reserve meets, let's say, every 6 weeks and decides what interest rates, et cetera, I honestly think you're going to see a situation similar to that, in that instead of deciding what interest rates are going to be, I mean, that might be part of the discussion, you will really decide what should the price of gold be, which will define the amount of reserve currency around and the kinds of trading that can occur. Now, it may be a lot more complicated than that because different currencies will have different weights and there could be, you know, weights assigned depending on, you know, what commodities are needed at this particular moment in time, et cetera. But that's sort of how I see it. So it won't be your mother's gold standard. It will be a gold standard in which gold continues to rise along with the scarcity of commodities, along with overall economic activity, but does it in a semi-managed way. I mean, there may be trading like there was in the 1970s. Look, 1970s, at the post-World War II period, everything was great in this country until the financial, until we went off the dollars, until we went off the gold standard. And we created this monster industry called the financial industry. They went crazy with money. And it's not a criticism of America. America was just great before this. It's just the way people are. Give them too much money, they spend it. We spent it on a financial industry. And all of a sudden, the country was not working together. And just to give you one of the worst examples of this is when they broke up, the way in which they broke up AT&T. They basically destroyed Bell Labs, which by all measures that you can think of in terms of what they created, everything from the internet to the transistor to the laser, etc., they destroyed it. They made it part of Lucent rather than making it part of one of the regional Bell companies and sort of allowing, you know, those companies to have, you know, higher rates just to fund Bell Labs. And we lost that. And since then, we've really lost our edge in terms of a lot of technologies and our edge in terms of education, healthcare. All this has come from all this massive amounts of money that we've been spending on regulations and bureaucracies, et cetera. And we have a financial industry today. You talk about food and you're worried about, you know, all these speculators, where all these speculators are feeding the pockets of the financial industry. Of course, we don't need to have speculators telling you, you know, what price you pay for meat, or if you're a vegetarian, what price you pay for wheat, or anything else. You don't need them. They're counterproductive. Right now, they may be serving a purpose because they may be holding gold prices down, et cetera. I mean, I kind of believe that, but that's a separate discussion. But they're not needed for the essentials of life. They should not be involved.
Do you think that the idea of, just to get back to Bitcoin, the idea of utilizing a digital currency as, or vis-a-vis Bitcoin, for the currency of a country, like everybody's going to go off of this and all of a sudden the United States is going to use Bitcoin for their currency, is preposterous. There's only a certain amount of supply, 21 million out there. A country needs to allow for the ebb and flow of money into the system. Would you agree with that?
I think it's extremely well put. And let me just say one quick thing about Bitcoin. Anytime China wants to, and this is kind of scary, if you look at Bitcoin, and one of the qualities that you need in a currency is the inability to counterfeit it. And Bitcoin, you'll see, if you look up Investopedia on the internet, you'll see Bitcoin's a great, great candidate for a currency because it's impossible to counterfeit. The only way you could counterfeit it is that if you have over 50% of the miners all coming together and agreeing on creating what's called a double spend, where you can use the same Bitcoin that's been created and buy a million different things with the same thing. I look at it as going to a coffee shop or 1,000 coffee shops and paying the same dollar for every cup of coffee, spending that dollar 1,000 mm-hmm. times. Right. That would be counterfeiting in Bitcoin. The only way you can do that is if over 50% of the miners come together. Well, guess what? China is mining 65% of Bitcoin. The U.S. is number two at about 7%. Right there with the U.S. is Iran, the Soviet Union, Nigeria. Kazakhstan. 85% of the mining in Bitcoin takes place in countries that are, you know, developing countries, not the U.S. China, in other words, and this is what really gets me about Elon Musk buying Bitcoin, because he's so dependent on China for his growth. I mean, totally dependent mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. And why would he be buying Bitcoin? Because that could upset China when they launch their digital currency, especially in Hong Kong, which is a way of announcing it's available for foreign transactions. But with Bitcoin, not only are we consuming massive amounts of energy, China has a tremendous amount of cheap energy that they can use through hydropower. That's one reason. But we're putting ourselves in a position that if this becomes, let's say it does go to $500,000, it could be destroyed probably in probably less than a day, it can be rendered worthless. The whole ecosystem will become unwound.
Really?
Once they start counterfeiting it, are you going to invest in something if you're investing in something that has no value, literally?
Well, there's no intrinsic value to begin with it. There's no intrinsic value.
Well, only in terms of the software creation. I mean, you might place some value on that because, you know, it's hard. I agree with you. There's not nearly enough value. I mean, you can value software if you want, but it basically has no role as a currency. Right. It can be destroyed as a currency. It consumes massive amounts of energy. It's a joke. And when I see the financial industry, Elon Musk, he's a little loopy. I mean, you know, maybe he has his reasons. Maybe he's working with the Chinese. You know, who knows? Maybe their plan is to let Bitcoin become massive in this country and then just shut it down.
Well, the higher the Bitcoin price, the better it is for him if he's going to take Bitcoin as payment for Teslas.
Well, the point is, it's not good for China. And if China, you know, gets angry at Elon Musk, I mean, right now Musk is making a deal. We'll probably have to make a deal. China's very smart. They really are in certain ways. Tesla has a presumably wonderful relationship with China. He's the biggest selling car over there. But he's also very, very likely to make a deal with it goes by the initial CATL. They're a leading battery company. And that, again, will make him, you know, they won't have to do a thing to Tesla, per se. They won't have to steal intellectual property because he will be using Chinese intellectual property to make his cars. And that will probably be a kind of quid pro quo. He right now is very, very dependent on China. And buying a lot of Bitcoin and getting it, you know, sort of at his imprimatur, you know, he was the richest man in the world until a few days ago. Now he's second.
Right.
But anyway, his imprimatur on about Bitcoin, you know, has boosted it. Now it's trading at $50,000. I mean, it's the greatest short of the century. The point is, you have to live with it. If it go, you know, you see with GameStop and these other things, short selling is not something I recommend. I just recommend not being there when it goes from whatever price to, you know, 1,000. That's inevitable, in my opinion. Mm. But it's also a sign of, you know, greedy financial institutions.
Well,
I mean,
that's not going to ever end. That's not going to ever end.
You see, you know, I don't mean to call him out. I think he's been a wonderful leader, et cetera. But Jim Fink, who heads the biggest, money management firm in the world, I think, with trillions and trillions. I forget the number of trillions of dollars. And he's been,
Larry Fink from BlackRock.
Yes, BlackRock. Yep. Yes, it is exactly BlackRock. Been pounding the table for, you know, climate clean energy, ESG. That's the symbols for, you know, companies that are very, very, you know.
Environmental, social, and governance. Yep.
Yes, yes. And, you know, been pounding the table. These stocks have, you know, carried these very, very high multiples. Yet they're considering offering Bitcoin as an asset that they're going to recommend. Recommending gold.
Nobody ever said irony was dead.
Right? No one did. But it's hard to believe this stuff. Yeah. It really is.
Well, and there's money in it. That's what happens. Let's just close up on this one item here. I know that you're advocating for various types of, commodities for the old things we talked about. What are some of the best ways to invest in this? Are ETFs, mutual funds, directly with the commodity itself, which is a little bit harder and needs a little bit more education? What's the best way to do this?
I think it really depends on the person. You know, unfortunately, because the financial institutions don't make any money selling gold, it's very hard to it's very hard to get enough of commodities. I should say ETFs would be a very good way of doing it. But, you know, I calculated ETFs represent about, I think, less than one. ETFs and gold and commodities, they represent almost nothing in terms of the stock market. But yes, if you can, and you're the typical investor, that would be, I think, a very good way.
And of course, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but you can respond and tell me if this comment is correct. Make sure that it's backed by the physical rather than some artificial mechanism to build the price.
Oh, yes. I mean, one thing I emphasize in my book, whenever you see an ETF or an ETN, exchange traded note, forget about it. Make sure, yes, Andrew, you're so right. I can't emphasize it enough. Do not invest in anything other than an ETF that is totally backed by gold and silver or whatever it is that you're investing in. And really the best way, and maybe for people that don't invest in the stock market, you can buy coins. Mm-hmm. Coins are
I still have acceptable. I still have eight quarter ounce Chinese pandas ranging from 1982 to 88 or so.
And you may have numismatic value there. They may be valued because they're scarce. And that's a tough thing, too, because, you know, you have to know something about it. But the internet has lists, and I put it in my book as well, of very well, you know, very credible coin and gold dealers where you can buy the physical stuff. That's the preferred way. That would be the ultimate way. Now, a lot of people are not necessarily comfortable, but everybody can buy coins. And if you can't afford a gold coin, you buy a silver coin. I mean, as I said, silver, and I think in the first part of this bull market, will do incredibly well. And I would take advantage of what you're seeing now. I mean, gold trading in the 1700s, high 1700s, that's a ridiculous price. That's not going to stay. I mean, it may go a little bit lower, but, you know, 10 years from now, 5 years from now, you're going to see gold prices incredible, much, much higher than you have right now. You're just going to need to. And if you don't see it, it's very unlikely we're going to have, you know, a smooth sailing world. I don't want to predict an apocalypse or anything like that.
Don't do that. Stephen Lee, thanks for joining us. He's the author of China's Rise and the New Age of Gold, How Investors Can Profit from a Changing World. We'll have all the information on episode number 703 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, where you can get that information. Of course, just look it up on any great book-selling site around. We'll have it. Steve, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Andrew, it was a great conversation. I mean, I really have to compliment you. You know this stuff so well. You probably know it better than I do. It was a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Great stuff. That was gold from a kind of a different angle, if you think about it, and really gives a little bit more insight into the whole idea of, you know, what's going on with the dollar, as well as other commodities and what's going to happen with inflation. So, you know, good stuff right there. I think very timely discussion with Dr. Lieb. We're going to end it right there. I want to thank everybody for joining us. As always, make sure to be here next week for some great tax tips. Tax tips and tax pitfalls that you need to stay away from, especially in this year with all that's gone on in the 2020 year. Check out all that we have to offer. You know, again, you want to look at what's going on with your IRAs, your 401ks, your individual accounts. Well, that's what we do. Send us a line, contact us over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Plenty of ways to check out all of the strategies, what's going on there, from the investology to the managed growth strategy, which is a long short strategy, hedging, as well as individual securities, and looking for the best of the best when it comes to stocks. And then on top of that, you have the global allocations, which is much more of a traditional style, globally diversified approach. Anyway, all of that available on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I want to thank everybody again for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.